not show the 25 to 50% decrease in blood flow, which is normally seen during mental arithmetic stress. The post-polios responded to mental arithmetic with blunted vasoconstriction between 0 and 27%, or with marked vasodilatation between 8% and 95% increase in blood flow. In the next slide, it can be seen that near nerve skin temperature decreased significantly with cooling in both the post-polios and the controls. Interestingly, there was no significant difference in skin temperature between the hands or between the two groups at any of the ambient temperatures. Moving from the autonomic to the electrophysiologic measures, it can be seen in this slide that the median motor nerve onset latency increased bilaterally with cooling, as would be expected in both the post-polios and the controls. The median sensory nerve peak latency also increased bilaterally with cooling in both groups. There were no significant differences in motor or sensory latencies between the hands or between the groups at any ambient temperature. However, at 25 degrees, motor latencies were clinically abnormal, according to our scale, greater than 4.3 milliseconds, in the more affected hand of three of the post-polios. At 20 degrees, motor latencies became clinically abnormal on the more affected side in four, and in the less affected side in three of the post-polio subjects. Sensory latencies also became clinically abnormal, greater than 3.6 milliseconds bilaterally in two of the post-polios, but this only occurred when they got down to about 20 degrees C. Motor potential amplitudes were between 64 and 90% lower in both hands in the post-polios as compared to the controls, again, as would be expected, but there was no change in motor amplitude in either group with cooling. In contrast to the motor amplitudes, as was alluded to this morning, the sensory potential amplitudes did increase significantly in both the post-polios and the controls with cooling. So-called giant sensory potentials, that is greater than 80 microvolts, were seen on the more affected side in two of the post-polios at 25 degrees and in three at 20 degrees. The mean amplitude was about 130 microvolts in the post-polios on their more affected side. So there was an effect in the post-polios and an effect of temperature in terms of the amplitude of the sensory potentials. Moving from sensory nerve function to sensation, the next slide shows the regressions that we discussed of subjective intensity rating on stimulating current. The post-polios are represented by the dashed lines and the controls by the solid lines. There were no significant differences, either between the hands or between the two groups, in the threshold for detecting the electrical stimuli. There was a wide variance in the threshold. There was also no measurable effect of ambient temperature on threshold in either group. Neither were there significant differences in sensitivity, that is, in the slopes of the regression lines between the hands in either group, nor was there a measurable effect of ambient temperature on sensitivity. However, the post-polios were significantly more sensitive to electrical stimuli on both their less affected and their more affected side as compared to the controls. As you can see, the slopes of these lines are much higher on the more affected side and on the less affected side in the post-polios as compared to the controls. The last parameter measured was the effect of low ambient temperature on hand function. The post-polio subjects reported that all four hand function tasks required increased effort at cooler ambient temperatures. This subjective report was associated in general with increased task completion times. Instead of presenting this data descriptively, let's take a look at a short videotape that shows decrements in performance on the small common objects and the large light object subtests. Also shown is a quadriparetic subject who was unable to perform the Jebson subtest because of the severe involvement and for whom we devised tasks which really demonstrate the decrease in her functioning at low ambient temperature.
Showing the configurations of the waveforms of the nerve conduction velocities. The first subject you will see is a normal control performing a large light object functional task. He performs them with normal speed and normal grasps. Now a post-polio patient will do it. You can see her grasp is different. She has more difficulty doing the task. She uses only her third and her fourth fingers and does not use her thumb or fifth finger. Now at 20 degrees, she has even more difficulty. She has to use her wrist and her arm to move the object onto the board. At this point, she can't even lift them, and she has to slide them across the board. Now the same control will move small common objects, picking them up and putting them into the can. He uses normal grasp and does them at a very rapid speed. Now the polio patient that you will see performs the same task. She has much more difficulty. She has a lot of trouble grasping the objects and picking them up.
This is a 30 degree, so one.
She doesn't control her fingers as well as the control did. She especially has trouble with the pennies that are the very smallest and hardest objects to pick up. Next, the same patient will perform the same functional task at a colder temperature. She moves even more slowly and has more difficulty grasping the objects. As her effort is increasing, her right hand tries to come in to help her out to perform the task. It can't be clearly seen in this video, but she doesn't use her thumb at all to perform the task. She picks up the objects by squeezing them between her first and her second fingers. As she tries to pick up the penny, she's having such difficulty that she finally has to use her right hand to stabilize the object to be able to pick it up. Patient that you will see next could not perform the other functional tasks, so we had to move these checkers in an effort to simulate a precise movement and trace this figure, which simulates a joystick movement. She has considerable precision at this warmer temperature and can complete the figure tracing to its full extent at this warm temperature. Now this patient will try to do the same task at a cold temperature. You can see that she lacks the same precision she had at the warmer temperature. The accuracy of her movement is not as good, and she takes several attempts to do the task.
Are the slides still on?
Thank you. As you can see, the subjective reports of increased effort and the performance decrements of the low ambient temperatures were associated with qualitative changes in motor performance. Prehensile patterns changed from precision grips to power grips or other facilitatory grips at the low ambient temperature. In addition, there was overflow of muscle recruitment to other areas of the body. This study has documented several of the effects of decreasing ambient temperature in post-polios. The findings that post-polios and controls had equal skin temperatures at each ambient temperature and had equivalent decreases in blood flow, that is, percentage decrease in blood flow with cooling, suggests that tonic and reflex sympathetic vasoconstrictor outflow were normal and were not hyperactive in these post-polio subjects. The blunted or paradoxical vasomotor response to mental arithmetic in these post-polio subjects does suggest that the sympathetic vasoconstrictor response to stress was actually decreased, possibly as a result of the damaged pre- and post-ganglionic sympathetic vasoconstrictor neurons.
The finding of lower mean blood flow at 30 degrees in the post-polio subjects is probably also the result of damaged sympathetic vasoconstrictor neurons, allowing the passive dilatation of cutaneous venous capacitance beds. This is a schematic of the upper layer of the skin, and the blue area shows the extent and depth of the median nerve at the wrist. Dilatation of the cutaneous capacitance beds would produce venous pooling in the upper 2 to 4 millimeters of skin, pooling which is evidenced by the violet color of the limbs in the post-polios, and which we have shown in another population to be associated with decreased arterial inflow to the upper layers of the skin. The combination of cutaneous venous pooling, which allows heat to radiate from the limb, and the decrease in warm blood flowing up to subcutaneous tissues will promote thorough and efficient heat loss from the limbs and thereby produce the markedly cold extremities which are seen in post-polios. This slide presents temperature measurements which were made at Columbia during the 40s by Penis, who, believe it or not, actually passed the thermocouple through the arms of control subjects. As can be seen in the upper curve, the slope of the temperature gradient through the arm is steep when blood flow is high to the subcutaneous tissues and venous pooling is low. There is a sharp differential between the temperature of the nerve, which lies between 4 and 10 millimeters below the skin, the blue region in the preceding slide, and the temperature at the skin surface. With cold exposure in the post-polios, the temperature gradient would look like the lower curve. The marked heat loss causes deep limb cooling, and both nerve and tissue temperatures will more closely approximate the temperature at the skin surface. It is this deep and thorough limb cooling that may account for the recording of clinically abnormal nerve latencies only in the post-polio subjects at skin temperatures which were equal to those of the controls. At equivalent skin temperatures, both subcutaneous tissue and nerve temperatures will be lower in the post-polios, and nerve latency will be prolonged beyond that which is predicted by skin temperature in the controls. The finding of bilateral hypersensitivity to electrical stimuli in the post-polio subjects was unexpected and must be replicated. The occurrence of the giant sensory nerve potentials in the post-polio subjects corroborates the findings of Ginsburg et al., but doesn't seem to be related to the hypersensitivity, since the giant sensory amplitudes were prominent on the more affected side and increased with decreasing temperature, while the hypersensitivity was equal bilaterally and was not augmented by temperature. The mechanism of cold-induced pain has yet to be described in post-polios or in controls, although it has been related to profound vasoconstriction. The cold-related pain and hyperesthesia in post-polio's affected limbs may be caused by the effects of profound vasoconstriction and cooling being heightened by a generalized hypersensitivity to pain. This first study, unfortunately, was unable to describe the mechanism responsible for the post-polio subjects' impaired manual dexterity and for their increased effort required to perform motor tasks at low ambient temperature. Further investigation is clearly required to document the pathophysiology of cold-induced impairments, both of normal and reinnervated muscle functioning, and in general, document the normal pathophysiology of the post-polio so that we can recognize new pathological changes. I'm going to put up a copy of our research agenda, or the projected agenda, and I'd like to be able to discuss that. I'd like to also talk about point five after we take questions. Because Dick earlier talked about the relationship between daytime fatigue and sleep disturbances, the possibility of sleep apnea, and something that we're finding in post-polios, and I'm sure that you've seen, something that we're calling random generalized myoclonus. So I'd be happy to answer questions. EMG stuff, please, Dr. Johnson. You can hit the lights if you like.
Thank you, Dr. Bruno, for some fascinating work there. I'd like to ask a question as to whether or not these same studies have been done on older individuals, say over the age of 70, to see what effect temperature has on their latencies as well as on their hand functions, and could you comment on that?
Unfortunately, very little research has been done in aging in general, and to my knowledge, no studies have been done. Is anybody aware of that?
I haven't done a study on it except my personal body.
Yeah.
you were talking about ambient temperatures, which means 68 degrees Fahrenheit, your 30 degrees centigrade, 20 degrees centigrade, is that right?
20 degrees is about 58? Oh, 68?
In Minnesota, it's likely that we have temperatures far below that. I'm sure that my skin temperature comes close to the outside air temperature. Yeah. At least my wife thinks so.
So does mine.
And so does your wife think?
She thinks her temperature approximates ambient temperature.
And the other thing is, I've found personally, and in our group from Minnesota, about 40% of our people experience additional weakness when exposed to prolonged cold.
Yeah.
But this is real cold and not 68 degrees, but I wonder if it's a function of cold that you're, of weakness associated with cold.
If the weakness is a function of the cold.
Yes, and that the incoordination or the poor hand function is associated with a decreased strength.
We have not measured strength, so I don't know, but that would be another thing to measure.
Richard Owen.
Hermiston, Philadelphia. I think that it's pretty well demonstrated that cold considerably decreases strength. There's some disagreement as to whether or not it occurs in a linear fashion or whether or not there's a cutoff point at about 20 degrees. I think that there are several possibilities as to why an individual may become weak when they're cold. I personally can't attribute it to a slowing of conduction velocity, and the reason for that is very simple. If you take a look at Charcot-Marie tooth patients, their conduction velocities can be 11 and still have normal strength, so that doesn't seem to be a possibility. I think if we take a look at the neuromuscular junction, cooling inhibits the breakdown of acetylcholine, so if anything, the strength should be increased. So I can't attribute it to the neuromuscular junction.
And also increases ACH receptor sensitivity.
And
you get a double punch.
Exactly. As far as the peripheral sprouts, I've often attributed the weakening that may occur in these partially denervated individuals due to the fact that there is a marked increase in temporal dispersion with cooling, and of course if there are fewer motor units functioning with the poor temporal dispersion due to cooling, that may well contribute to the increase in weakness in a neuropathic condition. The cellular conduction along the sarcolemma is it's also difficult to invoke that as a cause for the same reason that slowing along the neurons would contribute to weakness. I talked to Lind, and Lind questioned whether or not there was a sequestration of calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum or in the sarcoplasm itself such that it could not be bound to the troponin, or it was bound for a prolonged period of time, thus contributing to the weakness that's found in these patients. So I think that at least from an experimental point of view, it seemed that the best payoff to study these patients is your own studies, Dave, where you're taking a look at an increase in jitter in these patients and determine whether or not there's a marked increase in jitter with cooling that is totally consistent with the decrease in strength. Of course, when it comes down to the evaluation of the intramuscular sequestration of calcium or potassium for that matter, that of course must be done in animals.
Joe Comfort from Manitoba. Just one quick observation that may relate to Dr. Owen's findings, that in the more epidemiological studies, both the ADL and mobility indices vary quite a bit winter and summer. Clearly, some of it is a reaction to physical barriers and climate, given Manitoba. But other ones, particularly among the respiratories, maybe secondary temperature effects. Clearly, you've got secondary respiratory effects with really cold air that we're dealing with. But it's reflected in ADL changes from winter to summer readings, and particularly mobility.
I'd like to comment on two other
two other possible reasons, which I had forgotten. The first, of course, is that with cooling, the sensitivity of the spindles is markedly decreased. Therefore,
yes,
the reflex bias on the anterior horn cells would be reduced. And Walt, you had mentioned to me in the past, I think, that there's a possibility of an increase in the viscoelastic properties in the muscle with cooling, and of course with a markedly atrophied extremity, it would make more sense that there would be a through-and-through cooling process that may increase the viscoelastic properties. Those two are probably fairly readily evaluated at the present time with Berg's and Zumsky's method of intraneural recording to determine the activity of the spindle system, and also by evaluating viscoelastic properties of tissues with cooling.
The latter is something that we're going to pursue.
One question, that was Herbison. Weaker's asking a question. Did these patients actually undergo shivering?
That's another thing. They shivered way above the temperature at which the controls would have shivered. Our controls didn't. The polios began to shiver as we were ramping the room down.
You really have to wonder what the emotion induced by shivering is doing.
Herbison, I'd like to discuss a couple of observations. I had some unpublished observations on the skin temperature of the hand in left-handed individuals and right-handed individuals, normal. And the left-handed individuals is generally higher on the left side than the right, but it is not true, reciprocal is not true to the right-handed individuals. There are many right-handed individuals who have lower temperature in the right hand. That's number one. Number two, the during re-innervation due to neurograft, the conduction velocity in the nerves is very slow, and yet it does not reflect on the movement, skilled movement. However, if you decrease the temperature of the muscle, then you have increased slowness of the muscle itself, and this I think the reason. And finally, during sleep, the skin galvanic reflex disappears. But I think this is due to the brain and not to the sympathetic nervous system.
Let's talk about sleep for a minute if we could. In terms of differential autonomic activity, that's an area of great interest to me. And I'm not sure that we have any data that would be of any interest at this point. In terms of sleep, what we're finding is that post-polios are reporting that as they fall off to sleep, they have twitching that's generalized over their bodies, of course, in the muscle groups that are still functioning. And I'm wondering if that is a report that you folk have heard before. Is that common? Yeah, that's all. We had a report from one individual, a clinical psychologist in California, that his myoclonic movements, these ballistic movements, were so great that he bloodied the nose of his wife one evening and was forced to retire to the couch. What we think is that there is some kind of myoclonic process going on in some post-polios that may be associated with thalamic firings, K-complexes during stage two as these individuals are falling off to sleep. That's another aspect that we would like to pursue. I don't think that the daytime fatigue is associated with nighttime occurrences, myoclonic or otherwise, except in the case where sleep apnea would be diagnosed.
McComas Hamilton, I wonder if I could ask a question and make a comment. Comment first. As regards the effect of temperature, and particularly cold, on muscle contractility, it's been well shown that as one cools the muscle, the twitch becomes not only slower but very much larger, so much so, in fact, that in amphibian muscle, the twitch tension can reach the tetanic tension, and this is due to prolongation of the active state. Now, the second factor which affects muscle response to cold is a change in the viscous properties of the muscle, and this has actually been measured by Dr. Geoffrey Walsh at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, and he refers to the viscous properties as the thixotropic properties of muscle, and he shows that these do change. The question now, I'm very interested in your giant sensory potentials, and I'd like to ask you whether these were orthodromic recordings or antidromic recordings.
They were antidromic.
I see. Okay. Well, in that case, I can't follow up with my next question.
Okay. I think in terms of the sensory potentials, what we are in non-polios, you find an increase in the sensory amplitude with temperature. And what we've got in a post-polio limb is a very effective radiator of heat. It's shooting out all of its heat to the environment, and the temperature of the nerve is going to drop. So we just, I think, have an accelerated or an enhanced cooling process that's responsible for those huge amplitudes that you measure as temperature goes down.
Herbison, Philadelphia, I think that there's probably two reasons for the large amplitude with cooling. One is that there is there's more of an effect on the fastest conducting fibers than there is on the slowest conducting fibers. Therefore, there's a greater temporal summation. And secondly, the active state of the neuron is prolonged, thus each axon is in a state of depolarization for a longer period of time, thus the temporal summation is also increased. One suggestion I might make if you're while you're looking at this process of cooling, I started on a project on my own, which I didn't finish because I have to admit it's a little bit of a pain in the neck. What you do is cool the elbow and then warm the hand, and therefore you would have a direct effect of cooling of the nerve without cooling of the muscle to determine whether or not the process is within the body of the muscle or whether it is a more proximal phenomenon.
That's a good suggestion.
I might add that when we had done this on two or three patients, two or three normals, we did indeed find that there was a marked reduction in strength, even though the temperature of the hand was kept at 37 degrees centigrade.
I'd like to ask Dr. Owen a question. In the barren wastes, have you seen individuals who had such severe muscle weakness or pain that they required some kind of pharmacological treatment? The literature has articles discussing procaine and sympathetic blocks and Priscilin and other sorts of things. We have not yet encountered that.
I suppose the living in the barren waste makes Minnesotans more stoic or something, or it might be their Germanic and Scandinavian backgrounds, but we haven't really seen that. In fact, even the severe pain syndromes are quite rare in our group.
That's interesting. Thank you.
I would agree with that, but why does everyone move to Florida when they retire?
Common sense.
Are there any other questions? If not, we thank you, Dr. Bruno.
This concludes tape number 4.